Today's broadcast was originally recorded on November 5th, 2025.
The sun may have set over our city this evening, but as Eugene Debs once said, I can see the dawn of a better day for humanity.
Wow, Eugene Debs. That's a deep cut.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Actually, it's pretty good today.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
And there's no place I'd rather be stuck. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, an all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Doing slightly sweller than usual today for some odd reason. How are you, Desiree?
Doing sweller than usual as well.
There you go. That's Desi Doyen, our producer. So our friend Dread, a longtime commenter over at bradblog.com, rang in on the posting of our show late last week, the one that I posted at the Brad blog with the headline, A Pretty Weak Strongman, in which we cited on the show, among other signs of failure and weakness for Donald Trump and his regime, new polling that had found his approval ratings this month were underwater in 12 states that he won last year. Negative approval ratings in all seven swing states, Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, North Carolina, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. But even in five states that he won bigly just 1 year ago in November, his approval ratings are also underwater. That would include Alaska, Florida, his new home state, Iowa, Ohio, and yes, Texas. Of all places, negative approval ratings for Donald Trump in all of those states. So I posted that show and our friend Dredd rang in into the comments section to say in response to that and the other signs of Trump's growing weakness that we talked about on that program to say, quote, the system that can't stop him is weaker. Well, my reply to Dredd was, quote, I'm not counting on the system. I'm counting on the voters. His reply in kind, quote, that part of the system is known to fail too, adding, quote, like last time. Well, yep, he's right. Voters do make mistakes. Voters are, especially during presidential elections, especially during presidential elections that Donald Trump is running in, often wildly disinformed. But I would like to think, in fact, as noted, I am counting on it, the voters, not the institutionalized systems that have failed us over and over again, including the media, by the way, especially during the Trump era, but the voters will ultimately get it. And I think that Tuesday night may have proved that point once again. The voters triumphed on Tuesday, as I see it, in state after state after state, on one candidate after another, on issue after issue after issue. It was not even close in really any of them. Democrats and the voters that supported them on Tuesday won damn near everything, everywhere, all at once. At least in the states that held elections on Tuesday, and there were about 30 of them that had either statewide or local elections in the first chance that voters from coast to coast and many places in between had to respond with their votes to the first year of the failing second presidency of Donald J. Trump. The voters defied the media, defied the predictions, which said at least some of these contests would be very close. defied the threats and the intimidation of a weakening wannabe strongman, and the voters struck back, just as I had hoped that they would, but frankly, in even bigger numbers than I think any of us might have imagined. Now, I know you've likely already heard about most of the top-line victories on Tuesday. We will get to them, and we will be joined momentarily by the great progressive journalist and author and longtime friend of this program, John Nichols of The Nation, to get his thoughts on what all of this means and or does not. But just to make sure you heard how thorough this thumping was that Donald Trump took on Tuesday night, because he's already out there lying about it, naturally.
As he does.
You'll be shocked to hear. just to make sure, let's start with some of the lower profile contests first, for a change, some of which we tried to give you a heads up about before Tuesday, just to make sure that you fully understand what a game-changing triumph, I believe, that it was on Tuesday, with voters pushing back against obnoxious, cruel, overreaching Republican autocracy across the country on Tuesday. In Maine, there were just two questions for voters on the ballot. Question one, would it have mandated photo ID restrictions for in-person voting, shortened the number of early and absentee voting days. It would have limited the use of ballot drop boxes, among other changes, to make voting more difficult. Maine voters rejected that Republican-supported proposal by almost 28 points. Question two, in Maine, would establish a so-called red flag law to allow people to request extreme risk protection orders from law enforcement and the courts against individuals who are believed to be dangerous, prohibiting them from possessing firearms or other weapons. Yes, it would take guns away from people by court order in the rural state. That measure passed by 26 points in a rural state. There was an interesting mock election among high school students in Maine in the run-up to Tuesday's election, and I had wanted to cover that, but I didn't get to it. They rejected both questions, the students did. Question one on voter ID, and they voted in favor of question two on a red flag law. So the
high school students matched what actually turned out.
Well, I had wanted to share that with folks before the election, but I kept running out of time. I wanted to share it because by way of saying, look, I know these Republican photo ID restrictions have passed in state after state in recent years, but that the younger generation, at least according to their views on question one, that they seem to get it. Well, we may have to, you know, wait for them to become old enough to vote for reals, but the younger generation, they get it. That was my thinking, but on Tuesday night, apparently, everyone got it in Maine. As the photo ID restrictions to make it harder for people to vote went down in flames, and the red flag law was passed overwhelmingly. So it's not just the younger generation, it's all voters, apparently. In ruby red Mississippi, Democrats broke the Republican Party's supermajority in the state Senate for the first time since 2011. In 15 years, the first time they've done that. They flipped three Republican legislative seats in the state Senate in Mississippi. In swing state Pennsylvania, the most populous battleground state in the nation, all three state Supreme Court justices on the ballot for retention elections were, in fact, retained by voters for another 10 years, despite an expensive, if failed, GOP effort to unseat those three judges in hopes of winning a Republican majority on the critical swing state's high court in advance of the 2028 presidential election. But not even one of the justices was rejected by voters, and it was not even close in any of those statewide races. They each won by more than 20 points. The three victories ensure that the court's Democratic lean on the high court will hold through the next presidential election. That's a big victory for Democrats in the biggest swing state in the country. But that was not all that happened in Pennsylvania on Tuesday, as Daniel Nishanian of Bolts Magazine, who posts as Taniel on social media, noted. Bucks County, Pennsylvania, was ground zero for the conservative takeover of school boards and anti-LGBT policies back in 2021, on the Penn Ridge and Central Bucks school boards. Well, Dems actually flipped both boards back in 2023. But on Tuesday night, voters ousted all but one of the Republicans from both of the school boards, which are now 8-1 and 9-0 Democratic to Republican, respectively, in those two counties. Democrats also flipped Republican offices and county boards in Luzerne, Bucks, and Erie County, which is a bellwether county that Trump won in 2024. In Colorado, voters voted overwhelmingly to fund free school meals with a ballot initiative to raise taxes on high earners to fund those free school breakfasts and lunches. In the great battleground state of Georgia, one of our favorite states, as you know, not one but two seats on the previously all-Republican so-called Public Services Commission. It's what some states call their Public Utility Commission, which sets electricity rates for state residents, among other things. On Tuesday, there were two races for the PSC on the Georgia ballot, and Democrats won both of them. In what was the first time that a Democrat has won any statewide state office in Georgia since 2006. On Tuesday, they won two of them. The very MAGA Vice President J.D. Vance's very MAGA half-brother, he lost the race for Cincinnati mayor decisively in Ohio. In Detroit, Michigan elected Mary Sheffield as its first ever woman to serve as mayor in the city's history. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu became the youngest person to be reelected in the city's history. She ran unopposed on Tuesday. Why? Well, because her opponent, Patriot owner Bob Kraft's son, actually withdrew a few months ago after realizing that he had no chance of winning. And boy, was he right.
And people turned out anyway, even though there was no challenger for her.
They turned out everywhere, all over the country. And an election that, you know, an off-year election, we're not supposed to pay attention, it's supposed to be tiny turnout. No, that was not the case in state after state. And that is just some of the lesser-watched contests where Democrats won in race after race and issue after issue, winning everything, everywhere, all at once. They rejected Donald Trump and his Republican Party in case after case after case. In the higher profile contest, the story was the same. In the great state of California, voters stayed online for hours out here, even after the polls had closed, in order to cast their vote for one single issue on the ballot, Prop 50, to redraw our state's U.S. House map in response to Texas's Trump-ordered Republican theft of five Democratic congressional seats in the Lone Star State before voting even begins for next year's critical 2026 midterm elections, when the entire U.S. House will be on the ballot. Polls showed that that constitutional referendum here in California was likely to pass, but few thought it was likely to pass by almost 30 points, as it did. In the purple, trending blue state of Virginia, Democrats picked up a stunning at least 13 seats in the state's House of Delegates, going from the slimmest of 51-49 majority margins in the 100-seat House to at least a decisive 63-37 Democratic majority in the state's lower chamber, clearing the way, by the way, for step two, the second consecutive legislative vote next year to get a measure on the ballot also next year to rewrite the state's U.S. House maps to flip two or maybe three seats in Virginia from red to blue. Given the results on Tuesday night, I'd say it's probably going to be three seats in the U.S. House in response to the Trump-ordered mid-decade Republican gerrymanders across the country. Every single county in Virginia shifted blueward on Tuesday night. In fact, as pollster and data analyst G. Elliott Morris pointed out, quote, what we saw last night was a directional shift toward Democrats in 99.8% of counties that held partisan elections. But I digress. As to that huge new legislative majority in Virginia's House of Delegates, well, that will come in very handy for the state's new Democratic governor, former CIA official and Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, replacing the state's current Republican governor, Glenn Youngkin, after she defeated her Republican opponent by nearly 15 points on Tuesday. The Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor, Ghazala Hashi, won easily to become the nation's first Muslim woman elected to a statewide office. Democratic candidate Jay Jones defeated Virginia's incumbent Republican attorney general despite controversy over a text message seeming to call for political violence. He easily won. And in New Jersey, the race expected to be the closest one of the night, the large, you know, the highest profile one to be close, potentially giving Republicans their one major victory of the evening. Well, former Congresswoman and Navy helicopter pilot Mikey Sherrill defeated her Republican opponent, Jack Cittarelli, handily by 13 points. Again, it was not even close. But of course, the contest that is likely driving the Republicans craziest today, so I'm happy to get on board of that. And even, by the way, driving some Democrats crazy, happy to get on board for that, too. We'll discuss it with John Nichols shortly, is the 34-year-old socialist Muslim Ugandan-born Democratic firebrand candidate Zoran Mamdani, who easily won the race for mayor in New York City over both disgraced former New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo, who was endorsed by Donald Trump, and Republican candidate and Guardian Angels founder Curtis Sliwa. That race was not close either, with Mamdani winning just over 50% of the vote and defeating Cuomo, his closest competitor, by about 9 points on a promise of an affordability agenda that includes a rent freeze on supposedly rent-stabilized apartments in the city, free buses, a pilot program for city-owned grocery stores to help lower produce prices, and universal child care, before going on to deliver one of the best political victory speeches that I ever recall witnessing. Here is a few minutes from the mayor-elect's 25-minute stemwinder on Tuesday night in New York City.
The sun may have set over our city this evening, but as Eugene Debs once said, I can see the dawn of a better day for humanity. For as long as we can remember, the working people of New York have been told by the wealthy and the well-connected that power does not belong in their hands. Tonight, against all odds, we have grasped it. As we turn the page on a politics that abandons the many and answers only to the few. New York, tonight you have delivered a mandate for change. Because of you, we will make this city one that working people can love and live in again. To every New Yorker, whether you voted for me, for one of my opponents, or felt too disappointed by politics to vote at all, thank you for the opportunity to prove myself worthy of your trust. Tonight, we have spoken in a clear voice. Hope is alive. Hope over tyranny. Hope over big money and small ideas. Hope over despair. And we won because we insisted that no longer would politics be something that is done to us. Now it is something that we do. In this new age we make for ourselves, we will refuse to allow those who traffic in division and hate to pit us against one another. In this moment of political darkness, New York will be the light. And we will build a city hall that stands steadfast alongside Jewish New Yorkers and does not waver in the fight against the scourge of anti-Semitism. Where the more than 1 million Muslims know that they belong. Now I know that many have heard our message only through the prism of misinformation. Tens of millions of dollars have been spent to redefine reality and to convince our neighbors that this new age is something that should frighten them. As has so often occurred, the billionaire class has sought to convince those making $30 an hour that their enemies are those earning $20 an hour. They want the people to fight amongst ourselves so that we remain distracted from the work of remaking a long broken system. Together, we will usher in a generation of change. And if we embrace this brave new course, rather than fleeing from it, we can respond to oligarchy and authoritarianism with the strength it fears, not the appeasement it craves. After all, if anyone can show a nation betrayed by Donald Trump how to defeat him, it is the city that gave rise to him. And if there is any way to terrify a despot, it is by dismantling the very conditions that allowed him to accumulate power. This is not only how we stop Trump, it's how we stop the next one. New York will remain a city of immigrants, a city built by immigrants, powered by immigrants. And as of tonight, led by an immigrant. So hear me, President Trump, when I say this. To get to any of us, you will have to get through all of us. If tonight teaches us anything, it is that convention has held us back. We have bowed at the altar of caution and we have paid a mighty price. Too many working people cannot recognize themselves in our party. And too many among us have turned to the right for answers to why they've been left behind. We will leave mediocrity in our past. No longer will we have to open a history book for proof that Democrats can dare to be great. Let the words we've spoken together, the dreams we've dreamt together, become the agenda we deliver together. New York, this power, it's yours. This city belongs to you. Thank you.
Democratic New York City Mayor-elect Zoran Mondani at the Brooklyn Paramount Theater on Tuesday night in New York City, blowing the roof off the joint.
Indeed.
So what does it all amount to? What does it all mean? That discussion begins after a quick break, and we will be joined by the great John Nichols of The Nation magazine. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast. Quite a night for a change. I'll take it. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. All right. Well, as you know, Democrats and other anti-Trump voters won in Tuesday's off-year 2025 elections in state after state. in partisan contests and on ballot initiatives alike, from the high-profile contests like the gubernatorial races in New Jersey and Virginia, where it was not even close, to high-profile ballot referenda like Prop 50's partisan redistricting measure in California, to state Supreme Court elections and local school boards in Pennsylvania, to, yes, electing an electric 34-year-old Democratic Socialist as mayor of New York City. As detailed in the previous segment, Democrats appear to have won almost literally everything everywhere all at once as the nation's voters in some 30 states finally had their chance to ring in at the ballot box in response to, well, the first 10 months of Donald Trump's second term amid the longest federal government shutdown in U.S. history, the largest ever cuts to health care, including the Affordable Care Act, Medicaid, and Medicare, rising prices that Trump has failed to lower as promised during his campaign last year, violence in the streets by masked federal thugs rounding up immigrants and U.S. citizens alike across the country, and a wholesale destruction of the federal government and even the literal destruction of the East Wing at the White House that voters were finally able to send a message about at the ballot box on Tuesday. Joining us now to help us put all of this in perspective for this year and what it all means moving forward into next year's critical 2026 midterm elections, I'm delighted to say, is our old friend and legendary progressive journalist and author John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation, author of more books on progressive politics than I can possibly mention, most recently with co-author Senator Bernie Sanders of a book titled It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. Oh, John Nichols, you have joined us for many a post-election day conversation over the past 20 years or so. I gotta say, some of them have been quite grim, or leaving us sort of grappling to find upsides or even trying to just figure out who actually won or lost. But frankly, not today, Satan. There seems to be a little question about what happened on Tuesday. So first, let's focus on the big picture for the moment. What do you see as having happened on Tuesday?
Well, a lot, my friend. And I do have to reflect on exactly what you said. We have had so many conversations where we were trying to find the straw.
Yeah.
Kind of, well, there was actually a pretty good result out there in North Dakota.
Right.
But now we are in the bizarre reverse position where when you look across the entire United States, you are very hard pressed to find any disappointing result. And the reason for that is pretty simple. Donald Trump is a year after his election, 9 months into his second presidency. It has been an unmitigated disaster. And we've said that, we've said it frequently. We've talked about, all the ICE raids and the, threats and assaults on Medicaid, assaults on hunger programs, shutdowns. You just kind of run through everything. We've all complained about it. Mm-hmm. And we've pointed to the polls that say, look, his popularity is way down. People don't seem to like him very much. But I don't think we have believed it fully. And then last night, you got the confirmation that across this country, from New York to Virginia to New Jersey to California, but also to Mississippi, where they took away the Republican supermajority in the state Senate, mm-hmm. to Georgia, where they were winning public service public service commission elections that they never win, to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, mayoral races in Iowa. It was just across the board. The Democrats won and won and won. And I have to tell you, I don't think there's any question that a portion of that is a reaction to Donald Trump. It is, and I know
only a portion, but, John?
Well, let me tell you, I'm going to offer two streams of thought here. One, a substantial portion of that is reaction to Donald Trump, accepted there. But also something else. I think that there is a There is an emerging consciousness of how to run for office on the part of Democrats. And I know they're not, as a party, they have no history of getting their act together. And they often have patterns of division and bumbling and things like that. But the truth of the matter is that if you look at these campaigns around the country, in all sorts of places, there was an understanding of, yes, you run against Trump, but you also run for something.
Yes.
Something, I think that combination has become more sophisticated. If it is well developed, and there's so much work to do, if it is well developed in 2026, I think it has potential to be incredibly beneficial to the Democrats. And I ask you this question, Brad, you've covered a lot of politics. Don't you wish that the 2026 midterms were last night?
well, no, because last night was fantastic, and maybe we'll get a fantastic 26 as well. I'd like one of these at least once a year, John.
At this point,
it's been like one every 20 years. I'd be really looking at the results last night as they were coming in. Usually, you know, on a good election night, you might see a bunch of stuff you like, but okay, we lost over there or over there. I mean, there was virtually nothing that I could complain about last night as far as the results go. And John, you're right on the money as far as, you have to give voters something to vote for. And certainly Zoran Mamdani did. We'll get to him in a moment. But I'm wondering what you think. What does it mean that a Democratic socialist won what amounted to a landslide in New York City? A Democratic former fighter pilot won as governor in New Jersey. A Democratic CIA officer one as governor in Virginia, all on the same night, all by huge numbers. What does it say about, well, first, the old Dems in disarray line, and about this notion that, you know, Democrats sort of have to make a choice between the progressive and the moderate wings of the party?
I think it says a lot about that. And one of the things is that's always been kind of a bogus choice, because there have always been people who blend the issues, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody very good on economics, but a little bit more cautious on social issues. Someone who's very, very good on social issues, but doesn't really come through on labor rights, et cetera. So you've always had a little bit of a mix there. But what you saw last night was pretty clear. With Zoran Mamdani as an example, not the only one, and there are obviously different people running in different ways, but with Zoran Mamdani, he came out early with a clear set of issues, and those issues were rooted in where he lived, right? Where mm-hmm. he was. And so, yes, he talked about affordability, but you realize that if some consultant had told him, yeah, go out and talk about affordability, say you want New York City to be affordable,
right?
He wouldn't have gotten anywhere. He'd still be out in Astoria in Queens. But what he did was figure out how to make it tangible, right? Okay. I know people find this place unaffordable. What are the things that would make it functional for them?
Right.
Fast, free buses, rent freeze, universal childcare, grocery stores in food deserts. You know, you run down the list of issues. These are very specific things, and he got more specific. Help the people who own food carts, you know, cut through the regulation on small business. It was a full spectrum of practical solutions to what they needed. And I think you saw a number of these candidates do similar things with education, healthcare. I don't think any pundit on TV last night talked about rural hospitals. Yeah. I can tell you that both, you know, Mikey Sherrill and Abigail Spanberger did mm-hmm. as candidate running in Mississippi, as did the candidates running in Georgia, as did the candidates running in other places around the country, because rural hospitals are a huge issue. My point here, Brad, is that I think that there were a lot of people who listened less to the consultant class and more to the voters they wanted to win. And I think that was very, very beneficial to them. I think there's one other thing as well. And that is that I was struck by the fact that Mamdani, from the start of his candidacy, from the very, very beginning, talked about Gaza. And that's a moral issue that maybe the mayor of New York doesn't have a big impact on, But I can tell you that is something that no consultant would have told him to run on. Right.
Right. You know, well, not in the largest Jewish city in the world outside of Tel Aviv, of course.
Yeah. They just wouldn't have told him to do that. And yet he did. And it was highly beneficial to him because it communicated that he was a candidate who actually believed in some things and was willing to say it, even if there were potential political risks. Now, I don't think it happened to be a political risk, but I will tell you, that is an emerging reality of our politics, that Democrats cannot seem like programmed, predictable candidates. Mm-hmm. They have a little more to them. And, you know, I'm not saying every candidate running last night had that. I do think this is an emerging reality, though, whereas the Republicans, and if we could just do a quick flip over to the Republican side, I would be fascinated. You know, turnouts were up everywhere, right? Big mm-hmm. boost. That boost in turnout was disproportionately Democratic, especially a lot of young people coming back into the fold, other groups that had seemed a little bit shaky coming back into the fold. But we have to wait till we see, you know, to the extent that there was exit polling, to the extent that there's other methods that we can look going down to the, you know, granular stuff of precinct by precinct. I'm going to suggest, I bet there was a significant drop off in Republican turnout.
Yep.
And Republicans don't switch over. It's not like somebody voted in most cases. I think in New York you saw a little, but in most cases they don't say, yeah, in 2024 I voted for Trump, but this year I'm going to vote for, you know, some Democrat. Can happen, but it's pretty rare. What Republicans do when they're disappointed, when they're frustrated, when they cannot figure out why Donald Trump wants to take away their Medicaid, when he cannot figure out why Donald Trump wants people in their town to not have food through hunger programs, when they cannot figure out as farmers why, you know, the tariffs are coming down, when they cannot figure out so many things of what Donald Trump is doing, and when they can't figure out why he's tearing down the East Wing of the White House, you know, all of this stuff, I think, made a lot of Republicans just sit home.
Oh, I think there's no doubt. I mean, it's hard to get behind any of this. We've been talking about on the show of late. There has been a new poll out. I think it was last week showing that Donald Trump is underwater in 12 states that he won just last year. So, yeah, there's obviously disappointment there, but there seems to be energy. And, I've long argued that you can't just run against something. You have to run for something. Clearly, that was something that Zohran Mamdani did very specifically. Everybody knows, you know, free buses, universal child care, city-owned grocery stores, et cetera, et cetera. He gave what I regard, frankly, John, you've been in this business longer than me, but I regard as one of the best political speeches, period, that I ever recall seeing, his acceptance speech on Tuesday night. You've been at it longer than me. You can, you know, tell me how you feel about that. But yet, even with an electric superstar candidate like that one, even on Election Day, Democratic U.S. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York refused to say who he was voting for in Tuesday's mayoral election. I mean, you know, WTF, John, what is wrong with these people that they can't even vote for a wildly popular Democratic nominee in New York City in a major election, even on Election Day when it looks like he's going to win?
Well, I think there's, two possibilities there, each of them troubling. Number one is that Chuck Schumer really doesn't believe in what Zohran Mamdani is running on. Like, he actually disagrees with it, mm-hmm. right?
Okay.
And Schumer's been around so long, you know, kind of charting a centrist path. I think the general assumption has always been he does it because of concerns about fundraising, concerns about keeping the Senate caucus together, things like that. Okay. Maybe we're just cynics. Maybe he really doesn't believe in where Zohran Mamdani's at.
Mm-hmm.
That's a legitimate thing to ask, because if you can't bring yourself to endorse your own party's candidate right. in your own hometown, that opens the possibility. The other possibility, I think the one most people do tend toward, is that Schumer misread this situation in an almost in such a dramatic way that it almost looks like it's malpractice,
yeah.
right? That he assumed that a 34-year-old Uganda-born Muslim democratic socialist was somehow, you know, too red hot, too controversial. And if such a person was elected mayor of New York, that somehow that would be, you know, attached to some Democratic candidate running in Iowa, right? Or running in Kansas yeah. or something. Well, the you know what the misread on that is? It's a dramatic misread because of something that Rahm Emanuel did recently. He was out in Iowa and he was apparently dissing Mamdani and saying, you know, Mamdani, that could never play in Iowa. There's special elections here. People are winning those special elections on, you know, down home issues, blah, blah, which as if Rahm Emanuel knew what any of that was. and apparently, if I'm right, and I hope I have this right, a reporter actually went out and talked to one of the candidates who won in an Iowa race. And the candidate said, oh, yeah, I'm really into Zohran Mamdani. You know, I'm very interested in what he's doing, talking about these affordability issues. I've heard it in Wisconsin. I've been to, I was in New Glarus, Wisconsin, population about 2,000, speaking to a group of people in the back of the village hall. And I mentioned that I would be going to New York the next day to interview Mamdani. And the whole crowd erupted and this is a rural, you know, farm and small town crowd. They erupted in thunderous applause.
Well, it seems to me not unlike the way they underestimated AOC all of these years. You know, when
right.
she was elected, oh, that's fine for you know, for Queens in New York City, but she's never going to play to a national crowd. Now she's out there getting the largest national crowds of any candidate, her and Bernie Sanders on their No Oligarchs tour. I understand, you know, why Republicans would oppose policies like a rent freeze and freezing buses and universal child care. And by the way, when you talk about home down home issues in Iowa, these are down home issues in New York City, you know, buses
right.
and so
right.
forth. So it's not right. like they're talking about, you know, some crazy scheme of, you know, nationalizing the oil industry or something. These are issues that are very real to people who live in New York City. They're not crazy ideas. They make a lot of sense to them. But to be fair, it's not just Schumer or Rahm Emanuel. It's also Senator Gillibrand from New York. It's also it's also Barack Obama, who's pretty good at politics. And he called Mamdani, but I guess he didn't officially endorse him publicly. I'm still wondering what it is those folks are afraid of. Are the Democrats here fearful that Mamdani will be a failure, or are they fearful that he will be a success?
Isn't that a good question?
Thank you.
And that really gets to the heart of it, doesn't it? Because there is this clear reality that Zohran Mamdani ran against Donald Trump. Donald Trump made that easy because Trump endorsed his opponent. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump made that even easier because of all the threats and things like that. So for Mamdani, that was a pretty clear and easy, expressible political desire, political focus. But he also ran against essentially the establishment of the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And he clearly suggested there's a better way to do this. And I will show you how to do it. Now, I think there are a lot of Democrats who in the consultant class, who in the donor class, who probably would prefer that no one came along and showed them how to do it differently. Because it's worked very well for them, even when they lose. But for grassroots Democrats, for the people who actually want the Democratic Party to be something, to stand on issues, to have some sort of reflective nature, i.e. reflecting its own base and bringing their ideals, their values into our politics, what made Mamdani exciting was he was consultative. He asked people what they needed.
Mm.
And how government could be on their side. He then reflected that back to them. He brought them into his ads. Think of how many grassroots New Yorkers you saw, you know, talking with Mamdani in a video or something like that.
Yeah.
And so he developed out a different kind of politics. What is that kind of politics? Not reliant on immense amounts of money. New York has public financing. That's very, very helpful. But that also puts a restriction on how much you raise and spend. But rely instead on massive numbers of volunteers, tens of thousands mm-hmm. of volunteers. And you know what? That is a replicable model for campaigning. And you say, well, not every place has public financing. True. But Bernie Sanders showed people how to do massive small donor fundraising, and it actually works pretty well. It's not always guaranteed, but if you catch traction, look at what's happening with Graham Plattner up in Maine as an example, mm-hmm. and other Tallarico in Texas. These are candidates who have drawn in immense amounts of money via small donations. And then if you can excite people, and I know, Brad, this is a foreign concept to Democrats in the United States, you know, that you might actually build a politics that gets people energized and excited enough to not just come vote for you, but maybe go knock doors for you.
But yeah, that's crazy. You mean actually like the candidate, not just because, you know, you're supporting your party, but getting behind somebody who believes in something that you also believe in so that you believe in them. I mean, we saw that with, you know, again, AOC a few years ago. We saw that all the Democrats were terrified of her until it turns out, well, you know, she lights a fire under everybody everywhere. I think we're going to see a lot more candidates. I hope we see a lot more candidates like Mom Donnie, no matter what the politics are, frankly, just the way he runs, the way he relates to people and what it is that people are, you know, looking for in that particular part of the country. I want to hit a few more points here before we get out, John. Credit due to Governor Gavin Newsom out here in California. I know you're out in California today for Prop 50. What he did was no small feat. It was done in record time. It was about 90 days, successful beyond anyone's guess, like almost 2-1 victory, a huge turnout for one single item on the ballot, rewriting the actual state constitution in just 90 days, and I would argue resulting in reverberations across the entire country, especially by other Democratic governors on how to push back against this, you know, Republican authoritarianism that we are seeing in state after state. Your thoughts on what happened out here in California?
I think it's huge. And I think you framed it up pretty well there, because this was fast. It was a quick effort to develop an issue, a set of issues, and get people to think about something that they A, weren't thinking about before, and B, might not even have been that excited by, mm-hmm. right? California's put a big influence on trying to do a more of a nonpartisan redistricting. Obviously, California's a very Democratic state, but you know, the idea of redrawing the districts mid-season, why?
It's like the most in-the-weeds, geekiest thing I've ever seen. And yet, people were lined up at polling places, you know, until 9 and 10 o'clock last night to vote on this one issue. It was amazing.
And then we ask ourselves the very simple question, what's this all about? Well, what it's all about is this is another opportunity to push back against Donald Trump. And the framing of the process here was fascinating. He said, look, you know, Trump is out there trying to warp the 2026 election in a way that might allow him to maintain power. He's gotten Texas to do something for him. We're a big enough state to push back against that. Yes, we're upending some of how we do things. Some folks may not even like everything we're doing. But the fact is, in practical politics, this is what you need to do. You need to do this pushback. That's the basic argument they made. And, you know, initially there were literally a lot of pundits. There were political class folks, journalists who said, yeah, I don't think it's going to work. I think it's going to be a lot of Californians who at the very least don't like it. Mm-hmm. And also very questionable whether they're going to get all that excited about it, right? Whether they're going to actually come out, you know, even if they're, you know, kind of minimally supportive, can they get really excited? Well, the evidence is that A, you could talk to people reasonably, rationally, make an argument for something that needs to be done and get them excited enough about it to come out in way disproportionately high numbers.
Yep.
And so what this does, I think, and this is a big deal, because people will talk about Newsom as a presidential candidate, and he may or may not be that. You know, that's to be sorted out. But he did something that was really smart here. He seized the issue at the moment when he could. And in so doing, he created a circumstance where people in other states can now say, oh, okay, you could go into those weeds. You could, you know, push on these issues and get people excited about it, make it happen. Yep. Why does that matter? Because Republicans are trying to redraw the maps in Ohio, in Missouri, in states where they have the potential to petition a referendum onto the 2026 ballot that puts the gerrymandering of those states by Republicans on hold, right?
Mm-hmm.
So instead of accepting the new maps, you have a referendum on them. And if the referendum loses, you know, if you defeat the idea of the maps, they don't go into play. But at the very least, they don't go into play in the 2026 election. Why this matters is that a part of Trump's strategy now has been, since California offsets Texas, you got to go elsewhere. Well, there are tactics and strategies that might work elsewhere to prevent Trump from getting what he wants. So Gavin Newsom has proven a concept,
yeah,
and then handed it off to other people to potentially take it where they need to go.
He has, and he's proven that it can be done in inventive ways. And I think what we're seeing in Virginia right now is perhaps the most inventive way so far to make this happen. It looks like they're going to be able to redistrict and flip as many as three seats in the bargain. Of course, all of that may be for naught if the Supreme Court undermines Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, but that's a different question for a different day. I got about a minute left here at best, John. Norm Ornstein posted to social media last night as results were coming in, quote, "This could end up being a clean sweep for Democrats." Spoiler alert, it was. All three Pennsylvania Supreme Court elections, Virginia, New Jersey, and California, Trump no doubt will go ballistic. He added, but it will put Republicans in Congress on their heels. Expect some resolution of the shutdown very quickly thereafter. Norm Ornstein, of course, congressional historian, knows as much about this as you and I combined, I suspect. Does he have it right there when it comes to, knocking Republicans back on their heels to the point where they're going to say, hey, we got to get out of this shutdown and we got to get out quickly?
He might have it right. And I have great respect for Norm, so I'm not questioning his skills at analyzing these things.
Mm-hmm.
I think literally Republicans right now are taking this in, right? They went to bed last night thinking, wow, pretty big storm hit. They wake up this morning and find out it was a huge storm, and it went into their states. Now, for Republicans who live in districts where Kamala Harris won,
mm-hmm.
and there's group of them, I think this has to be the ultimate wake-up call. It's sort of like, you are going to lose in 2026 unless something extraordinary shifts. And so for some of them, yeah, there might be a self-protective desire to go and maybe push your leadership to get better on some of these issues. For many other Republicans, though, there will still be that fear that Donald Trump tries to primary you. And now you have the additional threat that you might get beat in November. That will cause deeper conversations, and it may lead to some movement on the part of Republicans, particularly in the Senate, where the truth is that we now are starting to see a framework where more Senate races could come into play, even in places like Alaska.
Mm.
And if that is the case, then you're going to see incumbents, and especially like Susan Collins out of Maine, who will perhaps become more aggressive. So yeah, can it affect the whole shutdown? Potentially. But I still think that the challenge with the shutdown is that there is no bargaining middle ground with the Republicans and the Democrats. They've had very little evidence of being able to find a place where they can even begin a conversation. I think there is likely to be some sort of resolution to the shutdown very soon, but I don't think it's going to be an agreement. I think it's more likely going to be some continuing resolution, that softens things for a little bit. And so that I just think you put that in a box and you have that reality. Separate from that, I do think there's going to be, for a lot of Republicans, a really hard rethink about whether, you know, whether they want to lose their primary because Trump goes against, because they went against Trump and then Trump punishes them by backing a challenger. Or do they want to go and lose in November?
Well, I like that choice for the Republicans. Do I want to lose in the primary or do I lose in the general? Which one? Enjoy the choice, guys. You brought this upon yourself. John, I got to get out. John Nichols is a national affairs correspondent for The Nation, contributing writer for The Progressive, associate editor for the Wisconsin Capital Times, and the author of many books, most recently with Senator Bernie Sanders, titled It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. You can check out his work right now at thenation.com, where he writes today with Katrina Vandenhoevel about Zoran Mamdani from Mission Impossible to Mr. Mayor. You can also find him on the social medias at Nichols Uprising. Glad to have a happy conversation with you for a change about elections, John. I look forward to the next one.
If we're getting on a streak here, I'm glad to stick with it.
One in a row. Thank you, brother.
Thanks, brother. Greatly appreciated.
All righty then. What a night indeed.
Oh, no kidding. And you know, the things that jumped out at me just from today. Yeah. Mamdani saying, if you come for one of us, you have to go through all of us.
Yeah.
And John Nichols saying that the thing that he gathered from all of this is you have to run for something, which is something you've been saying for a long time.
Yeah, you have to, you know, give voters something to vote for.
Not just against.
Right, not just against. Although you also, especially with what we're dealing with now, you also have to run against something.
Like fascism and authoritarianism.
Exactly, that seems pretty easy. So you can run against fascism, you can run in favor of democracy, and you can tell your voters what you would like to do if they put you in office. And then, oh, by the way, try to actually do that.
Yes, that's the other part.
A lot to learn this week, and now a lot to look forward to in the coming weeks. As a matter of fact, I think we can look forward to tomorrow being joined by Driftglass and Digby.
Yes, we can.
They may have a thought on what happened on Tuesday.
I bet they do.
Until then, my thanks again to The Nation's John Nichols, to our producer Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It's always appreciated. It's always an honor. If you missed any portion of today's show, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. We have no paywall there because we want you to be able to get all of this good and hopefully accurate information. But that is made possible by those who hit a donate button or go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com, and on the social medias, you will find me at TheBradBlog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.